searching but not finding, understanding anyway. We're lost in this masquerade.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is January 3rd, 2007, ladies and gentlemen, second broadcast of this new year. It's great to have you with me here tonight. You know, we on the French Connection have always prided ourselves in the quality of our research, and basically we are pitching this battle based upon the things we discover through research. And one of the main places that I have discovered many of the roads I've gone down is this next guest that we have on today. His name is David Pidcock. He's a friend. He's a researcher. He's a businessman. He is a teacher. He does all kinds of stuff, David. You wear a lot of hats, David. I got to tell you.
A lot of hats, I suppose.
And he's having a bit of a holiday with his family, and I've pulled him away from his family for a short time here to talk with the listeners about where we are, and more importantly to start with is the financial situation we face. David was involved in counseling Malaysia for a time on its financial position just in advance of and after the Asian implosion of the 90s, and I gotta say that you did them a very good turn, David. Where is Asia right now? More specifically, how is Malaysia measuring up to the other Asian economies after your advice?
Well, I think I shouldn't say it was entirely my advice. I was really the letter carrier, or the one who had the job of actually getting the message to Prime Minister Mahathir.
Mm-hmm.
And I met him at the Langkawi Air Show, which was just prior to the collapse of the Asian economies, and I was able to deliver a survival plan designed by James Gibbs Stewart and a group, Ken Palmerton, who worked together as the Forum for Stable Currencies.
Yeah.
It was good fortune that I've been working there on the Twin Towers on some access things, and was able to get the information that enabled them to actually shut down the particular problem areas and were able to ward off the IMF.
Well, see, here's the interesting thing. This implosion actually envelops many nations. Brazil had some problems, but more importantly, Argentina was really caught off guard, and so was Russia. What were they doing? I know that Soros was involved in currency manipulation that started a cascading effect. Now, this manipulation, was it to degrade the value of hard assets so they could be bought up at cheap prices?
Well, it's always the game of usury, is to actually beggar thy neighbor, as I think the saying goes.
Mm-hmm.
And usury are the people, by the way, who deal in interest, and they speculate with currencies. Hugh Kingsmill described them as excrement living on increment, which I thought was probably the best description that I've ever heard of the money changers. But of course, it is a game. It's an ongoing game, but we've been running this game for many centuries. It's not a new issue, and it goes back to biblical times. It's something that runs throughout history. You'll find that the speculation and the games for dispossession have been developed for many thousands of years. It's now, of course, much more sophisticated, and you can basically destroy, as we found when we had the Black Wednesday here.
Yes, in 87, yes.
Yeah, and this was, of course, a part of, first of all, we shouldn't speculate with money, and money is not something that should be considered as well.
No, it's a median of exchange, right,
it
David?
It is, but what's happened is we've allowed it to become wealth itself, and there's a brilliant quotation that I was reading. It's by Jonathan Porritt, Capitalism as If the World Matters. And he quotes David Corton, who's written many books on the subject. And the problem is, as he's saying here, that we're suffering from a predatory global finance system driven by the single imperative of making ever more money for those who already have a lot of it. and basically goes on, and it is rapidly depleting real capital, that is human, social, natural, and even physical capital, upon which our well-being depends. And he's saying that pathology enters the economic system when money, once convenient as a means of facilitating commerce, comes to define the life purpose of individuals and societies. And this issue of trading in money goes, if we go back to the 11th century, Imam Ghazali, the great Islamic scholar, warned about using money and allowing money to be traded. And Abraham Lincoln, of course, implements this model of the, what he calls, what we call the greenback dollar, where money is actually used to become the servant of humanity, not the master.
Yes, and didn't, and wasn't he, by some, scholars have pointed out that he was, they attempted to force him to go to the money changers for his financing of the Civil War of the North, and he refused and instead issued his own debt.
He actually went to New York, and they were demanding 37% interest. He got back to Washington and announced to the cabinet that he said, we have two great enemies, the Southern Army at our front and the financial institutions in our rear, and the greatest enemy is the one behind us. And this was then when he issued the greenback dollar, which was designed by David Ricardo, the great Jewish economist, in 1823, and it was the model that England should have had, but unfortunately we didn't get it. But Lincoln clearly implemented it, and of course Kennedy reintroduces it 5 months before they get rid of him as well. So there is a solution. Unfortunately, as we found, you know, if you read the Bible, the cousin of Moses opposed his abolition of interest under the Pentateuch, under the Deuteronomy and Leviticus. And then Jesus overturned his only violent act is overturning the money changers. He'd walked on water and they applauded him. He'd fed the 5,000. As soon as he touched the money changers, of course, he was in serious trouble. So it is a historical problem. We have a monetary problem historically, and all the wars and the conflict are traceable to this particular issue.
Are there more than one camp at the very top? Because it seems sometimes that these people are at the very top are not in full agreement on how to go forward with their next control thing. Do they work out of consensus, or do they sometimes develop into different camps?
I think that Jesus says to the people, when they say that he casts out devils with the aid of the devil, and he says to them, you know, a house divided against itself cannot stand. Well, of course, there has to be a pecking order, and usurers generally there are individuals, but I think they all recognize that they hunt in packs and they're more successful.
Well, that is true, and when they imploded the Asian economies, I think the cascade started with Argentina, did it not? I mean, they decimated.
Well, yeah. I think it's sort of an ongoing. It's like a disease. It's sort of it's like flu. It sort of catches people and then it moves on and it mutates. But the whole game, I can tell you now that in 1934, my father installed rolling mills in India. He went from Sheffield, and now India is the biggest producer of steel. It produced 34 million tons of steel this last year. But now the mill that my father installed is now closed, and more or less the disease that forced the mill to be sent from England to India in the first place, now the disease is catching up with it. So it's an ongoing thing, and it's been historical for thousands of years, this particular disease. So unfortunately, we, as they say, we don't learn anything from history.
No, we don't. And I understand right now that the Indian economy is very fragile. They're into huge deficit spending. In fact, 30% of their GDP at the moment. And in fact, when you look at the American economy and the Indian economy, there are very, very strong similarities between the excesses in government activity. And I'm wondering, is there a day of reckoning on the horizon here?
I think for America, I think India is actually a lot smarter. for once that the we should be following the Indians and not the cowboys. but they have a very big internal economy in India, and of course, and it is they have very good social cohesion. It's an excellent country, and the people are fantastic. I have to say that although my mother's family were there from 1840, and we've had a long history of involvement with India for over nearly five generations. But certainly I think once they understand the game, and they, of course, I've been trying to alert them to the American Monetary Act that's currently being pushed through the Congress now by Kuchinich, you know, this senator.
Yeah.
The American Monetary Act, of course, is to try and reintroduce or reconstitute the Constitution, which was abandoned in 1913. Now, I think the Indians, because if we look at India, one of its greatest exports was William Beveridge, who founded the welfare state here, the welfare society. And India has great thinkers, and it's had Gandhi and people like that, who all seem to have understood the problem, which, of course, is why they were assassinated in many respects.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like the rough, strong, self-reliant individualist that America once prided itself on describing as its citizen was given away by Roosevelt.
Wilson. Wilson was the he was the one who gave Trotsky his passport and allowed the first Bolshevik government to leave New York. I think there were 265 members of the first Bolshevik government went from New York with Wilson's blessing. But he is the one who signed the Ames Bill, or the Federal Reserve Act. And
you're trying to tell me that the people who took over Russia were actually exported from the United States to Russia?
Yes, they all went. In fact, the evidence is... I've given that in my own book. It was evidence given it was actually George Simmons, who was a reverend from St. Petersburg, and he gave the evidence to a Senate hearing in 1919 about the events that had actually happened in Russia, and that basically that the first Bolshevik government was almost entirely American Jews from New York. In fact, and he's listed all the members of that group who actually left New York. Now, the ship was stopped off Halifax, Nova Scotia, and the British were ordered to release the ship. And this, of course, is part of the evidence that we've given in this book, George Simmons, particularly his evidence, and this was given to a Senate hearing.
Now, interesting when we think about Russia and where it has found itself recently, but in its beginnings, in its Soviet beginnings, it's interesting that people, first of all, one of the things they made it seditious and criminal to identify a Jew in that
That's
country.
Right. Anti-Semitism was a punishable offense and has been since about 1905 when Kerensky made the first move in that. If I can just quote you from the Senate hearing in December 18th, this was the United States Senate hearing given by the Reverend George Simmons, who was superintendent of the Methodist Episcopal Church in St. Petersburg from 1907 to 1918. He said to the committee, which was on the 12th of February 1919, in December 1918, out of 388 members of the revolutionary government, only 16 happened to be real Russians. All the rest were international Jews, with the exception of one U.S. Negro. 265 of these Jews came from the Lower East Side of New York. Such has been the condition of affairs in the USSR from that day to this. Though a number of Jews were liquidated in the so-called Moscow Purge, this affected the situation in no way. It merely signified that one Jewish faction had triumphed over another and liquidated it. There has never been anything in the nature of a Gentile revolt against the Jewish domination. This was from the rulers of Russia by Dr. Fahy in 1935.
Now, we know all the way through up until 1989, well, a little earlier than that, people like Armand Hammer,
yes,
an American industrialist, philanthropist, Jew, who that's self-described.
Armenian, yes.
Now, he was ferrying very classified information, technologies,
yes,
and whatnot back and forth from the United States to give Russia the the facade of having a great technological base, but you would look at many of the things they built and they would almost be identical to the Americans or the British or whatever. In other words, basically, they were not real. They were a fabricated enemy, weren't they?
Well, of course, you have to make an enemy that is credible so you can tax the people. And, of course, it's the old British maxim called BSC, blame somebody else. Because the economies collapsed because of the failures and the ineptitude of economists and politicians who are not allowed to know that there is a third option open to all governments, which Lincoln exercised. Of course, he was shot 3 days later. And we have the evidence, I have it going back to 2400 BC, where they know how to actually resolve the problem, but they're not allowed to do that.
Well, now when we look at today's Russia, they got rid of the Khodorkovskys and the Berezovskys and the rest of these Jewish criminals, these people who went out and criminally stole. I mean, now, are they still in control over there?
Well, I think right from the very beginning, there's been never any change that the Wall Street and London have controlled Russia through the same families. It's the same banking families that control everything.
Well, didn't Rothschild step right in as soon as Berezovsky gave up his position at Yukos?
Yes, but you will find that it's like we have an alternating duopoly. If I can't have it, then we'll just change hats and you have it, and it appears that we've actually changed something, but nothing changes.
This is the Democrat-Republican model, isn't it?
Yes, I think it's called an alternating duopoly. You know, without one couldn't survive without the other. But as Napoleon pointed out correctly, that the representative government required to explain itself lies with impunity. You know, this is the nature of the beast. We've seen it now with looking at the history of particularly Pearl Harbor more recently with the events of what happened there with Roosevelt. Everything was prearranged, as we saw with 9/11. So we shouldn't be at all surprised to learn that. Look at what Wilson did when he admits when he signed the Federal Reserve Act that he's destroyed America.
Yep.
If I can quote you from this, was, of course, was 1913 when the Fed was established.
Yep.
And if you look on the Federal Reserve, you find it's in next to FedEx in the yellow pages. It is a private company, as is the Bank of England.
Yes.
And this is what Wilson said. Remember, Wilson was compromised. He was blackmailed because he was having an affair with a neighbor. And this was how they forced him. But he said, I am a most unhappy man. I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated. The growth of the nation, therefore, and all our activities are in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the free civilized world. No longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by the conviction and the voice of the majority, or the vote of the majority, but the government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men.
And he meant by that, he meant people such as Warburg, Conlobe.
Well, it was Paul Warburg. It was his. The Federal Reserve was his prize baby. I'm just studying now the full game. In fact, the best book to read on the subject, in fact, is Henry Ford's The International Jew, and there is a fantastic admission by a Jewish doctor in that, confirming everything that actually has been proposed by people on your program and elsewhere, that he admits that Henry Ford was in actual fact correct. So it's not something but unfortunately the information is not readily to hand, although I think I was told a few days ago you can download this now from the internet.
Well, you know, we've come a long way, baby, I'll tell you, David.
Yeah.
We really have come a long way.
Yes. But it's actually, there is phenomenal material that is actually already prepared. It's just that it's been prevented from getting to the general public because two and two add up to four. And whether you're in Russia or in South Dakota, it should always add up to four. But unfortunately, you know how things are, how how difficult it is at times to get the information out. I've been trying for the past 30 years, but there have been people for the past 200 or 300 years have been battling. You know, you go back to Cobbett, you go back through history, you find the same battle, and it's it's always the same people, the usual suspects.
We've tried a game of starting to name names. We go into the Kahns, the Loebs, the Schiffs,
yes,
the Warburgs, the Oppenheimers, the Millers, the Ratners, mm, the Crown family. We actually come out and say these are the multi-billionaire industrialist controllers, and we say that all roads lead back to them. In spite of seeing a large clutch of Christian Zionists as their henchmen, you still find in leadership positions the Zionist Jewish influence.
Well, but I think on this issue of Jewish and Zionist, there is a difference. There was a very important conference in Iran just last month.
Yes.
I'm sure you must be aware of it.
Yes.
What is very important is that there is a distinction between the Judaism and Zionism, of course. But what Moshe, there was the chief rabbi of the Orthodox anti-Zionist community in Vienna, Rabbi Moshe Ari Friedman, was at the conference along with many other rabbis from the Jewish community. And, of course, they are more anti-Zionist than you or I. And the point being that they have, they have been the victims of having Judaism hijacked as part of an agenda, as Rabbi says that it is the so-called Holocaust concept, and he's talking about Holocaustian, the Holocaust religion. And he's saying here, in his speech, he said that this Holocaust religion has been constituted precisely by those who, for their own God-assuming ends, demands worldwide validity for itself regarding its supremacy, whilst at the same time disregarding all international contracts, expecting the constitutions of the individual nation states and all religions, despite its irrelevance to them, to transform these into their secular Holocaustianity religion. It's a brilliant speech. It's about 20 pages, but he delivered this in Tehran. I understand that that there were other people there who, like David Duke, who people have been wondering why they invited him. And this is one of the problems for the Iranians. They tend to not be too critical. Often the enemy of your enemy, sometimes your own enemy.
Well, and they might well have known, being at least minimally savvy of how the press is controlled,
yes,
that they would have got terrible exposure on having people like Michael Collins Piper and like David Duke,
yes,
as representatives. These people are actually connected to neo-Nazi groups, white supremacy,
yes,
groups,
yes,
race baiting groups. And you know, in spite of David Duke, and see, here's the interesting thing, David. David Duke's group says a lot of factual things. He,
yeah,
he goes and does the due diligence in some areas and presents it accurately.
Yeah.
It's the face of his presentation that,
yeah,
is so offensive to everyone. And what it does is it works against you and I trying to get our message out, because we get swept up in the same with the,
sure,
same. I got to tell you, when he came back, he was interviewed by a guy named Wolf Blitzer on CNN.
Oh, yes, right.
And he did a very good job of what I felt was a good job of refuting Blitzer's arguments. However, when they couched his experiences the way they did,
sure,
he was seen as a dirty man,
yes,
in my view.
Yes. Well, this, of course, is not the first. I've, for many, many years, with all the groups, Palestinians as well as the Iranians, trying to alert them to the fact that image is one of the things that they've lost the argument. You never get a second chance to make a first impression. It's a corny line, but it's very true. And presentation is of course, when you see, say, Benjamin Netanyahu on screen, he's extremely articulate, very capable.
Yes.
And if you're not as good as they are, as it was General Booth of the Salvation Army, who said he when he heard, he decided to write a lot of hymns because he said, why should the devil have all the best tunes? And unfortunately, it seems that the Palestinians and the Iranians have not learned anything, even though they make beautiful things. But there is a group, and I'm wondering if, and I'm sure that you'll be familiar with the antinomian view, that sometimes they believe in doing evil, that good might come out of it. And
yeah.
There is a group in Iran called the Hojjatiyya, who also share this idea that, you know, if maybe you do something bad, that good will result from it. And it seems it's like using a shotgun, you know, when you should use a rifle. And unfortunately, I believe that there may be people of that group who may be may have a hand in things.
Well, after knowing what they were able to do with the Turkish nation, and I don't discount any possibility of having direct representation of the Zionists being played out within the context of Iran. And so, because, you know, look, the Young Turks that came out of that that movement a century ago,
yes,
certainly were such a minority. You would never have thought that they could bring bring Turkey to heel. But are similar activities being attempted in Iran? I'm sure.
Well, look, Iran has a large. I went to Tehran last year, sort of middle of August. There is a large Jewish community there, and a very sophisticated community. If the interest is as it's been claimed that the idea was to kill all the Jews, why didn't they start with the Jews that are actually in Iran? Of course, this is nonsense. But of course, it is there are far better publicists than the Iranians or the Palestinians or the Arabs per se, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The Young Turk movement was entirely, again, funded from New York, and it was this is all part of the prophecies that I've followed very and everything that happened in Turkey. Of course, it didn't fall in 1924 as people think. It actually fell on July the 8th, 1908, and it was a coup d'état, a bloodless coup. The British Embassy archives, I have copies of that, and I've included in my book, Satanic Voices, Ancient and Modern, was that the fall of Constantinople was to a Jewish Masonic group from Salonika, which was the most Jewish town in Europe, and everything stopped under Shabbat. And the British Embassy, the letters and correspondence from there show that it fell. And it was a Jewish rather than a Turkish revolution, as the British Embassy records show, and I have those here with me.
Well, they've never been able to resurrect the indigenous culture into a leadership role since then, and I'm sure the same kinds of things are being done now in Iran, in Iraq, and I'm wondering. What is the goal here, and do they care whether we know about them or not? I mean, it seems as though they still, with this hubris they have, they still go on with their planning in spite of having this. It seems like stuff's falling apart on them, David.
Well, I don't think so. I think that they want conflict and everything to reign supreme, because out of that evil, good might come. Is this sort of particular thing? But the idea of a united Iraq is one thing, but it was only united as a result of the British, the Red Line Agreement that was drawn by Lawrence's boss, you know, Gertrude Bell.
Right, they just went right down the middle of neighborhoods.
And of course, the Iraqi oil used to come by pipeline into Tel Aviv. It was a friend of mine's father used to manage that pipeline. So there is a lot that's going on. But I think the idea is to destroy anything that may have a cohesive origin. But of course, Saddam was our man. You know, as somebody said, he was a son of a bitch, but he was our son of a bitch until he exceeded his service function, you know, when he went into Kuwait.
Well, and well, at, we can, our ambassador from the United States gave him her blessing.
Oh, yes,
and
April Grassby, yes. He was April's fool, as they say.
Yes, she, April just said, you know, we don't take positions on Arab conflicts.
Precisely. But you see, there is a prophecy that actually said that the man by the name of Saddam, who will be deceived into going into the little Kuwait. There is prophecy that's existed for 1,400 years actually talking, and even America is mentioned in these prophecies. The tragedy is for the Arabs and the Muslims is that they've lost the plot. They've actually failed miserably to actually study their own legacy. And if they go back, you know, when all else fails, they say, read the instructions, and it's time that they started to do that.
Well, what do the prophecies say next?
Well, Saddam would survive, his sons would die, and then there would be, the second coming would actually be not be long after this particular events in Iraq. But it's very clear that America is considered, or shown, in the prophecies, as being the harlot, the one who has actually created deception and upset the whole balance of the world, and it's it's very clear that the events have all been not preordained, but they've certainly been pre-known.
Yes, but see, if you say America's doing that, David, I know that all of the real money in the world, all the real capital of the world is in the city of London and in the hands of a few families from Hamburg and from Bordeaux and from Zurich. And they really are the money muscle behind this fight, not the Americans.
Well, it's you have to hijack the whole system. And, of course, America, they tried to divide America because it was – a unified America was a very powerful body, but so they wanted it to be in two halves, but that failed. Of course, Lincoln tended to scupper that. But the prophecies say that when the Dajjal or the Antichrist, of course, those who tried to kill Christ have to be considered as not pro-Christ but Antichrist, and the emergence of that group would be, according to the prophecies, after the fall of Constantinople, which was in July 1908, the prophecies actually speak about the great war that would come within 6 years of that event, then within two more years, the emergence of Dajjal and the revolution which would enter every Arab house, followed by mutual hatred and hostility between the Arabs, which was in actual fact 1916 when Lawrence created the Arab revolt, and brought the Saudi family to power, which of course are from Al-Najd, an area in Arabia, which the Prophet Muhammad refused to bless, because he said from this place the horns of Satan would emerge. So the Najd, Medina, Riyadh, etc., the family, the group that came from there were known to the British and certainly known to Disraeli, and we nurtured and brought those people to power.
Well, it's funny that, you know, I watch the princes on TV doing interviews, and they're all opium-addicted sycophants. They just mouth their words out, and you can see them nodding off from either opium or heroin or whatever it is. And you know, they're just sitting there with gold-plated toilet seats and the rest of it. Their populations, in 25 million of them, many of these young men and women living in these Boweries don't have any future. It's not very different than what is happening in America or in Birmingham, England, or in go to Bradford and take a look around Bradford if you want to see a comparison between what the city of London and what Bradford is.
Bradford, I hope you're saying.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you take a look at how the poorest of us all have been treated, and then you look at these sick, overindulgent, hedonistic madmen, I think, are living their lives and at our expense. I'm wondering, how is it we're going to get traction on these different truths? There's so many truths out there that we need to focus on the most important, David, because, you know, people can turn away from this by sheer overexposure.
They can. I think the problem is one that the overarching or the overruling issue is one that the poor don't have to be poor, and the rich can remain rich, providing they don't prevent us from making the needs of the poor constitute a market. This is what Archbishop William Temple said.
Yep.
But of course, the decline. Although there's a brilliant book written by Moshe Menuhin, Yehudi Menuhin's father, called The Decadence of Judaism in Our Time. It could quite easily just change that and to say the decadence of Muslims in our time. They have become what the prophet predicted, and what's happening is predicted. The pursuit of building arrogantly tall buildings. If you go to Dubai or anywhere there, you find this madness of competing with one another in, and you've got poor people living there building these arrogantly tall buildings. And of course the prophecies are fulfilled against them. It's absolutely clear as day that the period for the second coming of Christ and Al-Mahdi, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, is very imminent because all the signs are there. There's very little left to happen. But things haven't happened. You mentioned something a little earlier, which if you read David Ben-Gurion's prediction, say, what would happen by 1987, in Time magazine, or Look magazine, and Life magazine, 1962, January, Ben-Gurion predicted all the events that we're currently witnessing, including the fall of communism, and of course everything happened in 1987 when Gorbachev started with Glasnost and Perestroika, and Ben-Gurion predicted. He said the image of the world is traced in my imagination by 1987. He said the Cold War will be a thing of the past. Internal pressure of the constantly growing intelligentsia in Russia for more freedom, and the pressure of the masses for raising living standards may lead to a gradual democratization of the Soviet Union. And Ben-Gurion, of course, Gorbachev came to power exactly in 87. On the other hand, he said, the increasing influence of workers and farmers and the rising political importance of men of science may transform the United States into a welfare state with a planned economy. Western and Eastern Europe will become a federation of autonomous states having a socialist and democratic regime, with the exception of the USSR as a federated Eurasian state. All of the continents will become united in a world alliance at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished and there will be no more wars. In Jerusalem, the United Nations will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind to settle all controversies among the federated continents, as prophesied by Isaiah. Higher education will be the right of every person in the world. A pill to prevent pregnancy will slow down the explosive natural increase in China and India. And by 1987, the average lifespan of a man may reach 100 years. That is Ben-Gurion's prediction. And tell me what hasn't happened apart from the average lifespan reaching 100 years.
Well, And they did build that court building.
Built. Everything's... And 3 years ago, who was in Jerusalem and who was calling for world government was Shimon Peres and Gorbachev.
They yes, there, and in and fact, they, in fact, Rothschild building that building.
Great.
And he's still paying for the immigration of Jews to the Holy Land,
yes,
and giving them
yes.
large sums of money.
Yes. But, this seems
to be backfiring on them right now.
The prophecy is when Dajjal, because the group who are any government, as the rabbis will tell you, no Jewish group or link with Jews should ever set foot in Palestine, in the Holy Land, till the Messiah takes them back, till God orders them to go back. This whole thing, this whole episode, or this whole issue of Israel is contrary to the Torah. It's absolutely diametrically opposed, which is why the rabbis went to Iran in December in support of the Ahmadinejad, the move to actually dismantle it. I think the Rabbi Weiss, David Weiss, said he called for the peaceful dismantlement of Israel and Hollywood as being the two essential things for world peace.
Well, see, now, David Weiss has been on this program three times.
Right.
And now, here's the interesting thing, that here's the wild card, and excuse me for not adhering to the religious dogma very much, because I don't necessarily fall into that camp. However, I think the wild card here, David, is something they didn't expect. And of course, technology can change everything in a blink of an eye. This internet came upon them by accident, and they did not understand when it was introduced just how powerful it was going to be. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the politicians that they had in their pocket were even claiming they invented it, such as Al Gore.
Yes.
But here's my point. It has gotten out of control from them. They've lost control over this, and they're in a situation, a very sticky situation, that if they're seen as the force behind the elimination of the freedom of the internet, there will be a revolt against them. That's clear to me as day. And what I see is that this internet is kicking the teeth out of these people day after day, and it's starting to really affect world opinion. And I think there is a cascading effect on the horizon against them, where they are no longer able to hide out in their deceptions.
Mm.
Yeah. And
well,
I mean, this may run counter to your prophecies in some way.
Well, no, they will fail for the reason that the idea to control the world has been the dream of from everybody from Genghis Khan or even before then.
That's right.
But they will fail because this is what the prophecies say. When Dajjal or the Antichrist fails to bring the control of the world under his control through his machinations and false systems of disbelief, the Christian nations will gather under 80 banners to try and bring peace in the world, but will betray the world and bring about its destruction. This is the United Nations that came about exactly in the time frame of events from the first, from 1948. And the prophecies are all very clear that the UN is that body, it's been a disaster. You know, wherever it's gone, it's created mayhem or has justified a Holocaust happening. You know, they just gave them the blue berets and they legalized something that should never have been legalized.
Well, David, you know, they're immoral as well. I mean, they know about the child sex slavery that goes on under their control.
Yes.
They know that after they balkanized the Tito's Yugoslavia, that many of the young women over there were turned out as prostitutes.
Sure.
There were murders that were going on, crime ridden. It's just real sick stuff happening.
Yeah.
at the hands of these people. What kind of moral bankruptcy is involved in their leadership?
Well, look. If you look at the United Nations, its patron saint is Zeus. You know, the most ruthless of the pagan gods. If you enter into the UN building, you find you have the meditation room. It's all built on Kabbalistic or black magic type stuff.
So these Kabbalists think it's okay to trade in children and the rest of it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
the Talmudic tradition of actually, not the Torah now, but the Talmudic tradition that came out of Babylon, where they actually sacrificed people to gain power. And this is a Kabbalistic belief system that is actually still played out in some places. Am I wrong?
No, it is, but it's part of this magic. It's part of what came out of Babylon, and if you have to read books by people like Israel Shahak, who was dead, Professor Israel Shahak, who clearly identifies the problems. He survived Belsen as a 9-year-old boy. He came out and he became a professor of organic chemistry in Israel, and was and you have now Israel Shamir, who is another. I don't know if you've spoken to him at all.
Yes, he's been on my show twice.
Yes,
he's afraid to speak on this program because they said they would do something to him in Israel.
Yeah, well, this is, of course, is a problem. You have Mordecai Vanunu, who blew the whistle.
Yeah.
And, of course, there is no freedom of speech. But they're a criminal, a bent mentality that they believe that doing evil, as, you know, the Goldstein, who killed those people in Hebron. On his tomb, it said he murdered to sanctify God. Now this is antinomian belief that you can do something, and something good will come out of it.
Yes, the left hand of God can be cruel while the right hand is good.
Yes, yes. But this, of course, is if you're brought up on that belief, then it's very difficult to break something that's been inculcated or imparted to people, and they go on and I'm afraid that this is the thing that we are facing. That it's something that they criticise, say Pakistani or the madrasas, but the stuff that goes on with the Zionists or with some of the Sephardic or the extra, the ultra religious Jews, other than the Natura Carta, who are Torah conscious, but the other group follows some very strange ideas. Israel Shahak said 9 out of 10 in the synagogue in the morning prayer would be worshipping Satan, and only 1 out of 10 would probably be worshipping God. And this is what we believe, that they follow a monotheistic idea, but it's certainly a very contorted one that that nobody in the right mind or with a belief in the God of the Old Testament or the Quranic view could possibly follow. But it's I'm afraid it's a disease that has to be rooted out.
Well, now I have one last subject to bring up with you before we end this wonderful session of education here, David. Is America's finances are on the verge of collapse, in my view. I see incredible imbalances, and I see the rest of the world still ponying up. Last week, Fed credit increased $30 billion. Now, that's a huge increase, and $2 billion of it was sold to themselves, which I didn't know you were allowed to do. But the Europeans still ponied up $10 billion in the Fed Treasury bill sale. In other words, the rest of the world is still propping up America, and I'm wondering, as long as they're willing to ship their money to the United States, this thing could stay on indefinitely. I'm wondering if you see anything imminent on the horizon that's going to take the legs off from under the American economy and just crash the whole darn thing.
Well, I think that is part of the policy. It's like if America is going to become a welfare state with the planned economy, you have to do what they did in Germany. You have to destroy the middle classes. You'll have, of course, this was the hyperinflation was purely to destroy the group who could have opposed the changes that Hitler brought in. I mean, they brought him to power, and this was the Bush family, particularly Fritz Thiessen and Avril Harriman and that group,
mm-hmm.
Brought Hitler to power through the ballot box. And with the foundation of the Fed, it enabled basically the Federal Reserve to control the world economy in conjunction with the Bank of England. But the idea that that there is a problem. Bernard Leite, who designed the euro, who was the head of the Central Bank of Belgium, he is against a single currency and says what we should have is a common currency. And if you notice in France and Germany now, there's great opposition to the euro because it is a disaster.
Yes.
The whole thing is about people are bought into the American dollar. If they withdraw, it's like going cold turkey. All the monies that they have, the Chinese, I think, have got over $1 trillion. They have to keep supporting the Chinese, the spinning the plates. You've got to keep spinning all the things and keeping everything going until you find a solution. And the idea that, as Bernard Leite said, the present system could collapse in as little as 2 hours and they couldn't stop it. I think there is a switch now. A friend of mine, Chris Cook, has actually set up this bourse for the Iranians that they'll be trading their oil in euros now, which of course is what happened to Saddam the year before. He'd started to actually start trading his oil in euros. So I think there will be a switch. Russia, China, and Europe will actually, there will be a switch into the euro. But it will have to be It can be solved. You see, there's nothing to stop a government or governments actually stopping the carnival and just by issuing, as Lincoln did, using Treasury money. It could all be stopped overnight. But that would, as Keynes pointed out in the 30s or early 40s, you know, this spells the euthanasia of the rentier, the usurer, the one who lends money. Would actually have to commit, it would be euthanasia for him. And they fought this for 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years. But sooner or later, as Lord Acton said, the issue which is swept down the centuries and must be fought sooner or later is the people versus the bank. And, that's what we're facing. It can be solved, but of course, it's like, was it St. Augustine that said, God make me good, but not just yet?
I've actually recited those words a few times. but you know, David, I got to tell you, you know, I believe you're right. I believe, however, I don't know that the imminent collapse is going to happen, because so many times I thought we were looking at the last days, and somehow they've kept it going months and months later. So I've given up on predictions. However, what I do know is the imbalances are actually getting worse, not better. And so there is a day of reckoning somewhere out in the very near future. Just when that is, I don't know.
Well, look, if America devalues the dollar, of course it means that whoever's holding paper against them, of course, you've actually imported huge, you know, shiploads of wealth in exchange for pieces of paper. Now, providing the paper pieces of paper are stood behind by the government and not in the hands of a private group, such as the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England. You've only got to read what Jefferson said. You know, he's saying, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continents their fathers conquered. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs. Jefferson understood it. The solution is very simple, but unfortunately, as we've found for certainly the past 400 years, we've had to fight the Germans and the French when the enemy was actually in the city of London. Our great enemy is actually within our own country.
That one square mile, huh?
Yeah, the square thing.
Well, I mean, you know, but their money holdings go, I think the principal country after America and Britain in this mess is Switzerland. And I think Zurich holds one of the main keys to this whole thing. And you brought up something interesting about the main city in Switzerland in our private conversation.
Oh, Bob.
Could you share that? Yeah.
Yeah, but I was reading the Everyman description of Basel is based on the Baal, the golden calf from the time of the Israelite Exodus, and the Bank of International Settlements is in Baal. And in 1997, the Refa Party in Turkey actually held an anti-Zionist conference in the same hall in Baal where the Zionist conference took place in 1897. And I went there, and the Bank for International Settlements was Keynes and Harry Dexter White called for the closure of the Bank for International Settlements at Bretton Woods, because what people, there's a brilliant Time Watch program called Banking with Hitler that shows that the Americans, the British, the French, the Germans, the Italians, and the Japanese were still meeting in Basel in Switzerland during the entire period of the war. They were supposed to be at war with each other, but they were still meeting there, and in Basel, in Switzerland. But when I got to the building, I noticed that there were three vultures. There was one circling, and then there were three circling just round the top in a triangle, which I thought, this is rather astonishing. But it was rather appropriate that this is, you know, the vultures. Where else would you find all the vultures in the headquarters of the vultures, the Eyrie?
Well, and the last subject, I guess, I keep saying that, you know, I'm one more over here, but gold, You know, my belief is that the gold standard is the only standard, and it would eliminate derivatives, it would eliminate hedging, it would eliminate all of these fancy ways of making money into a monster instead of a medium of exchange. But we were off the gold standard. Where do you see gold in the role of the future, and what do you see as the way the bad guys are trying to use gold?
Well, gold has always been a problem because it is a finite resource, and as Lincoln understood perfectly, the opening of his address in 1865 sums up the problem. Abraham, he said, money is a creature of the law, and the creation and the original issue of money should be maintained as the exclusive monopoly of national government. And he said, then he goes on to state that gold and silver, there's an inadequate supply of gold and silver to satisfy the spending power of government and the buying power of consumers. And whoever's gone on to the gold standard have found that unless you actually control the pricing of gold, which takes place 10 a.m. at St. Swithin's Lane at 10 a.m. Rothschild every morning, or you control the production of gold, as soon as you go on to the gold standard, as Winston Churchill found in 1928, he then was going to hang the governor of the Bank of England for treason, for betraying the British and putting us on the gold standard. Because what happened, he said he was promised that we would be anchoring ourselves to stability and certainty. And he said, but what has happened since? The price of gold has suddenly gone for, is increased in value, in cost by 70%. And he was going to hang Montagu and Ormond for treason. So the idea of gold is something that's stabilizing. It isn't. Because if you don't control the production or the pricing of it, you are absolutely at the mercy of those who own this small amount of material that cannot cover all. How many trillions of dollars is trading at the minute? There isn't the amount of gold actually to have that as convertible.
Yeah, but it stops the ability of these people printing money ad infinitum. Well, In other words, if you had a central bank that actually looked at the number of ounces of gold they had sitting in their vaults, they could actually fix the price to that sum and then use that as the exchange
bait. Yeah, but the point is there's no necessity to do that. If you have, you need a commodity standard. And this is what the battle should be about, that if you're in Malaysia, you should have a tin standard. If I can convert my ringgit into 1 pound of rubber or 1 pound of tin, then this is real wealth. Gold is virtually good for filling teeth and certain other things. But once you say that everything, if you're living in an island that doesn't have gold, then you mean that all trade shouldn't be carried out. It's a monumental myth, this gold thing. It works at a certain level, but there are better ways, and unless you control where is all the gold from Fort Knox, it evaporated, didn't it?
Yeah, it's gone, every bit of it.
But there's no necessity, because what the gold, they don't need gold to back anything. You need, as you say, if you put a million tons of gold on the piano, it'll never play Mozart. It requires, you know, warm bodies to do things. So it is a bit of a red herring.
Well, what if there was a basket of commodities that they use?
Sure.
From around the world. In other words, they did an investigation of regional demand, regional needs, regional productions, regional, for Australia, South Africa might be diamonds, for America might be silver. In other words, put a basket of things together and use that as the basis.
Well, the idea is that we're working on two projects now. One with Chris Cook looking at this as asset-based finance for things, but also there's the RMU that we proposed in Malaysia at the Gold Dinar conference when Bernard Leiter and I went there, and we opposed the idea of a gold standard because it limits you to, and if you're a country that doesn't produce gold, then you're at the mercy of those countries that do. So you need a tin standard. You need a gold, a rubber.
Well, what if you were to say this, David, just for example, 7 tins equals 1 silver, 1 silver equals, I mean, 10 silvers equals 1 gold, 5 rubbers equals 1 tin, and you are able to allow that to be negotiated on a rather flexible way, depending on need-based and production-based.
Well, look, there is the RMU model. Actually, Harry Dexter-White and And Keynes took the perfect model to Bretton Woods. Harry X. Dwight was the American, and Keynes, but they lost the argument to those who control the Fed. They wanted Bancor, which was a method of, how it would work is if I'm, say, in Pakistan and you're in Malaysia and I want to buy rubber, the idea that you would use, say, a measure, let's say it was a dollar, that's for argument's sake, or sterling or anything. You actually use that as the rate of exchange on that particular day, but you don't actually buy the dollars. You actually just get your central bank to pay you in ringgits or in rupees the amount that it would have been. And if the price changes tomorrow, goes up, say, from 50 rupees up to 51 to the dollar, you just adjust it accordingly. But you're not actually buying the dollar. You're just using it as a measure.
That measure could be against a basket of things if you wanted it to be.
But what Lincoln actually said, the available supply of gold and silver being wholly inadequate to permit the coins of intrinsic value or paper currency convertible into coins and the volume required to serve the needs of the people, some other basis for the issue of currency must be developed. So Lincoln understood the problem, and all of them have understood it for several hundred years. It's just that the people who are running the scam don't wish to change their habits. They wish to continue with the system as it is.
Well, there's a lot to chew on here, David. I've missed our conversations, both private and on the radio here. We've actually got a bit of a history together, and I thank you very much for spending your time here with us. You know, we learn a lot every time we talk. This is a process.
There's a wonderful quote from Lincoln, and he said, "I see in the near future a crisis that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. Corporations have been enthroned. An era of corruption will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until wealth is aggregated into a few hands and the republic destroyed."
That's the day we're facing now.
Yes. And Jefferson, of course, he perfectly summed up the problem of the present monetary system. He said, "The modern theory for the perpetuation of debt has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens ever accumulating."
It saddens me to think that with all the knowledge of our forefathers, we still can't get it right.
Well, it means that somebody wants it to remain it the way it is, but it will change. There's no doubt, but it requires awareness and getting the message out to wake people up that there is a third option and we're being denied it.
We're never going to stop until these people are brought down. We want to bring their system down.
Sure.
And it's an act of self-preservation that motivates me to do that, and an act of love for my family and my children and my my fellow man around me. I'm looking at this, David, as you are, and saying, where are my grandkids going to be? Where is my son going to be? What's going to become of my world?
That's why we're doing what we're doing.
I'll never quit, and having you on this show helps us each time you visit.
Well, thank you. Well, it's my pleasure, and I'm at your service. I mean, that's what we're here to do. We're here to serve, aren't we?
Well, you know, I'm going to get in touch with you so I can get maybe a forward number so we can stay in touch.
Absolutely.
Thanks, David.
All right, Darrell. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too. Ladies and gentlemen, David Pidcock wishing everyone a Happy New Year, and if you're a lover of factual information as I am, and knowing as much as I do about this subject, and I pride myself on having done my research, this was just a powerful indictment of the criminals and a support for the work that Eric and Christopher, myself, and so many others, Sophia has done with her 9/11 mysteries, and Condit has done with his work, and Eustace Mullins, and you know, we are not ourselves islands here. We are connected to each to the other, and all of us are battling. And what I have to say to each of you now is that this fight must be taken to the next level. We are on the cusp of becoming a worldwide force. I examined the statistics on our website, and we are being heard in over 85 nations every day. That is a fact. And it is at the point now where our efforts are going to start bearing serious fruit, and it's going to place this world in a position of having to decide what they want for the future. And 2007 is pivotal in the battle for our freedom and the rights that we should all enjoy as human beings. What do you want, ladies and gentlemen? Do you want a crappy world to live in, or do you want something, things to improve for us all? Well, it's your choice. I choose better. I choose work harder. I choose placing these files on chat rooms and starting to support what Eric and myself and David Pidcock say with your own voice, and say, look, the battle is being waged here on the French Connection. We are fighting on behalf of these facts as they have been rendered to us, and don't shrink from the battle. Go to YouTube where you see our videos and support our work there. There's spammers all over these YouTube presentations we put together calling us anti-Semites and nutters. We need our own forces saying, yeah, you are the problem, and here's why, and point them to the right direction. And so when people come and read and hear those videos and they read the comments, they can get a further education. Fight the good fight. And you over at Google monitoring our work, we know you're monitoring our work, and we know, I know from your logon site on my site that your main headquarters, just outside of San Francisco, has been logging on for 600 minutes in 2 days recently from the main headquarters of Google. Now, one might ask what you are doing on my website and what is your intentions here, and are you working with the company Cadence, and is there a conspiracy that I need to have an attorney look into? The simple fact of the matter is, you are watching, but what you're watching is your own demise. We all know, ladies and gentlemen, that Google is an Israeli-controlled company. And if you doubt that for a minute, do the research. It is all available to you. Secondly, they have messed around with our statistics and started banning our work. They should be outed for it, and we should work against what they're doing so that these people know that their company is hanging in the balance for its credibility. Because the French Connection is a truth-telling organization, not a hatred organization. We're not against Jews. We're against criminals. Get it straight. Do the fighting, ladies and gentlemen. Pick up the banner and do the fighting. Until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith saying be well. Bye-bye now.